Hello and welcome to this Labor Day edition of Catholic Answers Live. Hope you are enjoying the last day of American summer. It may not be astronomical, a summer coming to an end, but American summer ends on Labor Day, and now the kids have to go back to school, and you can't wear white shoes anymore, and I don't know what the other concert. There used to be a telethon. I don't know if there's still a Jerry Lewis telethon, but Labor Day also celebrates the achievements of the labor movement in the United States, and they are many. Perhaps we'll discuss some of them with our guests today. But the primary focus this hour, we're going to talk about democracy and the Catholic faith, and with a specific question of, is democracy Catholic? This is one of our civic holidays, so it's a good idea to take those opportunities on the civic holidays to examine our own civilization, our own society, our own nation. Is democracy Catholic? To help us answer that question, at least he better help us answer that question, or this is going to be a long hour, is Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, the most important Catholic publisher of the 21st century. Mark, welcome.
Hey, it's great to be with you. And while I'm happy to talk about this topic under the auspices of my being the president of Ignatius Press, I also, you know, I'm a contributor to the Five Issues That Matter Most discussion, and I'm formerly the director of social ministries for the Diocese of San Diego. So that's kind of how I come at this. My interest in this topic goes back to my conversion to Catholicism, you know, in the early 1980s, but it also is rooted in my experience as director of social ministries and wanting to make sure that I understood Catholic social teaching very well and how that teaching intersected with or conflicted with American ideas about democracy and civil society and so on. So that's a little bit of background why I'm interested in this topic.
Well, if I may, there's a certain prejudice, I think, against the title social minister or social ministry in some circles.
Yeah.
So you're aware of this. This is not news to you.
No.
The idea is, well, that's kind of the PC side of the Catholic Church, or nowadays it's called woke or that kind of thing. What do you make of that? I don't know if that's a critique so much or just a characterization, but what do you make of that?
Ooh, very good question. Well, I mean, every once in a while I'll post something on my Facebook page about social justice and I get slammed. I mean,
I know people really hate that word. Yeah. Or that phrase.
Because a lot of people will say, oh, you're trying to espouse socialism or leftism. You'll get more thoughtful, kind of more traditional sort of, I'm going to call this Thomistic. I think that's maybe unfair to Thomism, but you'll get some people who are more traditional Thomists will say, well, you know, what in the world is social justice? And they'll sort of critique it from the perspective, well, it doesn't fit into sort of these classical categories. I actually think it does, but that's a whole nother question, what social justice is. But I think that the reaction to the discussion about social justice, which is, by the way, a term used in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it's not something that I invented or left-wingers invented. It's part of what's in the Catechism. You know, you can go back to 19th century Catholic social teaching, early 20th century popes used the term.
Yeah.
It's been used. So it's a legit term, but people will react viscerally and think that that means left-wing politics. And it doesn't, really. The social mission of the Church, I mean, Vatican II and Gaudium et Spes, the Constitution on Church in the Modern World, says that the Church doesn't really have a social mission as such. The Church's mission is religious, but the religious mission of the Church, nevertheless, is the source of energy, motivation for transformation of the social order, the society in which we live. So, yeah, I think sometimes people react to social ministries or things of that sort in a negative way if they think it's primarily about a particular partisan political agenda and not more broadly trying to live the gospel in society.
Yes. Okay. Fair enough. And a lot there. And
yes, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I just want to unpack some of it, because when you talk about social teaching, generally speaking, I will propose this to you. You tell me if this is correct. We're talking about teaching that follows from Rerum Novarum, 1891, Pope Leo, and it's on new things. Is that basically a good translation of Rerum Novarum or on the new order? Okay, so the idea...
Or you could say new stuff.
Yeah, new stuff. Okay. Basically, it's the Catholic response to industrialized society is what we now see as the Catholic social teaching. Is that fair or...
Yes. Well, what I'd like to, what I do is I say this, Catholic social teaching goes back to the teaching of the prophets in the Old Testament about how Israel was supposed to live with respect to all facets of society.
Okay.
And obviously our Lord, who's the fulfillment of, the Mosaic covenant, fulfillment of what God promised in the Old Testament, Jesus himself is the, at the center of what we should understand by Catholic social teaching, and he's really the source, sort of the ultimate authoritative source, as he is for everything we believe in and how we should live, but for Catholic social teaching. And so you can go from Jesus's teaching through the early church, through the church throughout the centuries. What happens in the 19th century with Leo XIII and Rerum Novarum is an articulation of the church's understanding of how Christians are supposed to live together.
Yes.
In terms of the issues that were pertinent in his day, that he was seeing emerging, like, as you say, industrialization, the organization of workers. And so there is both a positive response. Here I am, the Pope, Leo XIII is saying, and I need to articulate for our Christian people how they should be living today in this industrial society. That's kind of the positive side. But then on the negative side, there were all kinds of misunderstandings about how human society should be organized, both politically and economically. And there were, there was the extreme of sort of what is sometimes called laissez-faire capitalism, extreme economic liberalism that basically says government has no role, or its only role is to ensure property rights. And then on the other hand, the emergence of Marxism and communism and socialist forms of the relationship between government and the economy that were on the rise. And many Catholics at that time and other Christians were being tempted to say, well, since the church is for the poor and since communism and Marxism is for the poor, then the church has to be in support of Marxism.
Yeah.
And so Rerum Novarum is saying, no, the church isn't all in for laissez-faire capitalism, nor is the church supporting Marxism. So that's kind of the context of Leo XIII trying to address, take the perennial teaching of Jesus, deepen it, and apply it to the concrete challenges of the church in the late 19th century.
And over the century and a quarter or so since Rerum Novarum, there are lots of developments in this social teaching, including, as you said, the teachings of the Second Vatican Council, but Pope John Paul, Pope Pius XI, lots of popes contributed to this social teaching. And now we come to a moment where there is an increasing question in Catholic intellectual circles about what that teaching implies about how good a thing is liberal society as a whole, and is democracy really the best form of government?
Right. And so there's, in one sense, this is a longstanding conversation in the Catholic Church going back to the 17th, 18th, really the 18th century, although, the time of the Reformations, plural, the Protestant Reformation and the Catholic Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, there was a huge debate, discussion about government, because at the same time you see the rise of the idea of the absolute monarch and what was then called the divine right of kings, the idea that kings rule by divine right, that they get their authority directly from God. And therefore, people have no right to challenge what the king says. a lot of people think that that's the Catholic understanding, because they think of Catholicism being the predominant religion in the medieval period, and the medieval period predominantly being a period of monarchies, and therefore they link these things. So that's actually not accurate. It's an oversimplification of the historical relationship between Catholic thinking about political society and government and the political society of the Middle Ages, because this is a complicated topic, but truncating things grossly, oversimplifying, if you go back and you read St. Thomas on the idea of kingship and the authority of the king, you'll see that the king, yes, he exercises an authority from God, not directly from God, but then, you know, the Christian view is all authority that's exercised comes from God, whether it's the authority of the king or the authority of the president or the authority of the mayor of a town, or any kind of authority that's exercised is exercised by virtue of a participation in what God has allowed human beings to do and how God has allowed and intends human beings to operate. So the long and short of the medieval understanding of authority is that it comes from God. It's to be exercised for the benefit of the people, and it's not a divine right that any earthly authority exercises directly. That notion that emerged 16th, 17th century in the West really was a kind of distortion of the authority of kings, and to some extent was a claim that kings are making over and against the authority of the church. They were saying, well, yeah, we have the right to decide these things because we have an authority directly from God. So the church comes in and says this or that. You know, really the church needs to understand that it functions as a division of the state. So that was the idea there. So that's a little bit of the backdrop of this question about liberalism. Liberalism is a political philosophy. We don't just mean, sometimes when people say, we hear the term liberalism, they'll think that means political liberalism.
Right.
In the contemporary sense of being left-wing, the member of the Democratic Party, or even beyond that. By liberalism, we mean a political philosophy that puts a premium on the idea of freedom or liberty, as understood in the political community. And really, and I know there'll be people who will slap my face for my saying this, but an overemphasis on the autonomy of the individual.
And
autonomy here being understood as freedom to do what I want, so long as I don't interfere with you,
right,
and you're free to do what you want. So recently there's been a lot of debate and discussion about the question, is the American political regime primarily liberal in that sense?
Yeah.
Or are there other elements to the American political regime that moderates its liberalism in that sense? And whatever the answer to that question is liberalism as such a good thing or a bad thing or something in the middle?
We have to take a break, Mark, but let's get into that when we come back, because one thing that the Catholic Church has been good at for its 2,000 years is understanding the dynamics of community, what makes communities healthy,
yes,
and what makes communities unhealthy. And I'm just going to go crazy out on a limb. Our communities are looking kind of unhealthy right now. So it may be,
wow,
there might be some profit in listening to what the Catholic Church has to say about true community. We'll do that with Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, when we come back.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
We talk to audiences all over the world. One thing I've found out is everybody in the whole world has the same set of questions. They live the same human life. They all want meaning. They all want love. They all want significance. They want forgiveness. That's the most fascinating thing to me. The same answers work wherever you are throughout the world, because we're all children of God.
Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders tonight, 11 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, Labor Day edition. This being one of the primary civic holidays in our nation, time to talk a little bit about our nation. And it's a democracy, at least that's what we're told. And so, and I'm not saying that in a dismissive way, but there is debate about that too. Is this a democracy or not? Today we talk about, is democracy Catholic? I talked a little bit about the health of communities. And that this is a primary Catholic concern. As a matter of fact, this might be one of the ways that Catholicism is distinct from some of our fellow Christian communities. We tend not to be individualistic. We tend to be communitarian, that we see yes. the person cannot thrive on his or her own. That is an impossibility. And that we have to, in order to, for the person to thrive, the community needs to be healthy. And so it's not just about individual rights. It's also about building up those things that make communities healthy. Am I on the right track? I feel like I'm doing really good right now.
You're doing a great job.
And
that's an important point, that the Catholic vision of the human person is we are not a bunch of autonomous individuals that get together simply to make sure that our autonomy, our freedom to do whatever the heck we want, is protected.
Right.
We need to be together to be good, to pursue the good. And the good involves more than autonomy, more than freedom, we'll say. And so that's an important point, that we foster free. We live in a society that fosters freedom for the purpose of the pursuit of the good, not just simply so I can do whatever I want. And the Catholic vision says that there is objective content to the good. It's not just a matter of, well, I'm gonna let you pursue what you think is good, and you're gonna let me pursue what I think is good.
Right.
And we have these rules to allow us to do that. No, there's also some objective content to the good. Now, how detailed a society wants to get in spelling out what is the objective content of the good is another question we can debate. But there is objective content, and the idea is that our government ought to be encouraging people not to pursue whatever they happen to think is good, but there's actually a content to it.
Right. You know? Yeah.
And our politicians recognize this when it comes time to commend young people, for example, to pursue their aspirations in college and to do more than just pursue as much money as they can make, and all these kinds of things that we have speeches, at graduations and things of that sort. There are a whole set of values that seem to inform what this pursuit of the good, or to use Jefferson's language from the Declaration of Independence, pursuit of happiness, what that happiness consists in. And it's a very ethical understanding of happiness when the speechifying occurs.
Yeah, right,
but
on graduation
day. In other contexts, we tend to have the least common denominator sense of right. happiness and good, and it's whatever you think is good, that's good for you, and whatever your worldview happens to be, well, then that's perfectly fine. And in that context, then democracy becomes a term that's used to describe the legal framework that we allow to exist in order for us to do well or whatever the heck we want.
Right.
And that's a problem from a Catholic perspective.
And this has very practical applications. For example, the rise of no-fault divorce in the United States and other places, and the idea that in a Catholic vision of the world, divorce would actually be more difficult to get. Right. And there would be a moral censure, if not a legal censure, to say no, because you divorcing is not just a matter of you living your best life. It's a matter of you breaking down something that the society needs not to be broken down.
Exactly. And I mean, that's a very good example. And we could probably spend a whole show just talking about how we should think about divorce from a legal point of view in a society that whose political institutions reflect what is really good for human beings. And I'm saying that, I'm cognizant of the fact that there are people, now probably not too many Catholic Answers listeners, but some people out there who will say, you know, that's the problem with not just the Catholic Church, but, you know, many of these more politically conservative articulations of democratic society, people bring to the discussion what they call a thick notion of the good life. That is to say, with lots of definite things that go into what constitutes the good life, and they don't like that. They prefer an understanding of political society and American society in particular that's very thin on the details of the good life. And of course, that's something we can debate with them. But you're right. The example you give with respect to divorce is an example of the question, well, what would that look like in a society that is not just democratic,
but
in
Catholic.
A sense we'll talk about, but that's reflective of values that the Catholic Church thinks are human values, not just specifically Catholic values, but authentic human values.
So it strikes me that the people themselves, this is where I want to challenge you about whether whether democracy is Catholic. The people themselves have a tendency to act as a mob. And so democracy will tend over time to stop defending things like marriage in favor of individual rights because people are selfish. So democracy is not Catholic. What do you make of that argument?
So I think there's something to that. And we're going to make some distinctions. Now, what we're going to say, as the Second Vatican Council says in Gaudium et Spes, you know, the church isn't wedded to any particular political system. So when we say, is democracy Catholic, we have to be careful. We don't want to give the impression that you can turn to the Catechism of the Catholic Church or the documents of Vatican II or the teaching of recent popes, and you're going to find the declarative sentence, the only form of government that the Catholic Church will recognize is democratic society. You won't find that.
No. Right.
Okay. So we want to be clear on that point. The second point we want to make with respect to the question of democracy and what you're describing, the rule of the mob, basically, the least common denominator, rule of the mob, is one of the ways in which the ancient political philosophers, especially people coming out of the Aristotelian tradition, that is to say the tradition of reflection on political matters that goes back to Aristotle, the Greek
philosopher.
In the 4th century B.C., and we should say that St. Thomas Aquinas gave a very Christian interpretation of Aristotle, made use of much of Aristotle's thinking in his own teaching on matters political. And the church is, obviously St. Thomas has an important role to play in the church's own thinking about these kinds of questions. But Aristotle criticizes what he used the term democracy in a negative way. Aristotle described various forms of government. He distinguished them, he put them into two categories. Those forms of government, human government, in which the ruler rules for the benefit of the ruler. And those forms of human government, which the ruler rules for the benefit of the common good or the interest, the general good or the general welfare of the people. And he said, okay, those are two kinds of government. And those two different forms of ruling can express themselves in the form of the rule by one, the rule by a few, and the rule by the many. So the rule by the one, one ruler, rule by a few, small number of people ruling, rule by the many, all the people who qualify as the people. That's another thing we can get to in a moment, ruling. And he said, you can take these two forms of government I talked about earlier, rule of the ruler, in his own interests, rule of the ruling interests of the good of all, and you can apply it to this one, few, and the many. And when it comes to rule by the one that's in his own interest, we call that a tyranny. Rule by the one that's in the interest of the people, we call a monarchy. the rule by the few in the interests of their own interests, call an oligarchy. The rule of the few in the interests of all is called an aristocracy. And then, said Aristotle, comes to the question of the rule of the many. The rule of the many, when it's pursued in the interests of, we'll say, the majority, all right, interest of the majority alone, versus the rule of the many pursued in the interest of all. He called the rule of the majority in their own interest democracy. So when we want to say, we speak of American society as democracy, Aristotle said that's not a good thing. That's a bad thing.
So but what does he call it when it's the rule of the many for the good of all?
A polity. That is to say,
polity, yes.
The right. Word polity comes from the word polis, which means the city or the political society.
So democracy falls on the bad side of the ledger for Aristotle. We'll explore that.
As he's using that word,
yeah,
yes.
We'll explore that a little more when we come back. Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press and the author of The Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics, is our guest. We'll be right back to continue our conversation on democracy.
Catholic Answers Live.
Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" Turns out that today, as back then, this question has a lot of different answers. So many groups want to appropriate Jesus, tweaking his identity until he looks and sounds just like one of them. But then you no longer have the Lord, says apologist Trent Horn. You have an imposter. In his new groundbreaking book, Counterfeit Christ, Trent exposes 18 phony versions of Jesus that we encounter today, helping you to recognize the fakes when you see them, explain why they're phony, and make a case for the full truth and beauty of who Jesus is, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Order your copy of Counterfeit Christ today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Have you subscribed to the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter? This is Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett, and I want to tell you about our new weekly newsletter full of behind-the-scenes information and facts you need to know about the show. It's easy to sign up. Just visit CatholicAnswersLive.com and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front of the page. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's happening with the show and see what's coming in the days ahead, delivered weekly into your inbox. Sign up today for the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter and see what you've been missing. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking book by apologist Trent Horn, that one book you can give to anyone as a starting point for helping them to find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Mark Brumley is here. He is the president of Ignatius Press, and they do a lot of good stuff over at Ignatius Press. You can visit them at Ignatius.com. I'm looking at your face to make sure I got the website correct. Ignatius.com.
You did. Ignatius, I-G-N-A-T-I-U-S.com.
Ignatius taking its name from one of the finest men in the history of the world.
That's right. St. Ignatius of Loyola.
Yeah.
By Confessio, by the way, Jesuit.
A follower of St. Ignatius, disciple of him. Is that what you call a Jesuit? Confrere of him.
The order founded by St. Ignatius. Right. But he's actually a disciple of Jesus.
Well,
it's called Society of Jesus.
Yeah, okay. All right. Have you ever heard the joke about you can tell what side a Jesuit on is whether he bows his head at the word society or at the word Jesus? So my Jesuit cousin told me that
Slam.
One.
Slam.
Okay, Mark Brumley, we're talking about democracy. Is democracy Catholic? And you shocked us in the last segment by saying that Aristotle used the word democracy actually as a, in a pejorative way to say that when the majority is ruling in its own interest and not in the interest of the common good, then that's a democracy. Otherwise, it would be a polity, and a polity is better than a democracy.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And that's Aristotle's use of the term. Now, of course, the word democracy in modern parlance has come to be seen as this just incredibly always good thing. And that's what generates some of the controversy, not just in the church, but in society in general, about around the question, is democracy a good thing? And when that controversy is, you know, engaged, it's no one is saying that the majority should always vote in its own interests rather than what's really good for the whole society. So that's not the debate. Should the majority, in order to have a is democracy a good thing, doesn't mean should the majority vote for its interests over the interests of, you know, the minority.
Right.
Most people would say no, even though we believe in majority rule. Most people would say that doesn't mean that the majority could decide tomorrow that it's going to vote to take away the civil rights of minorities. Everybody would agree about that.
Okay, so then you said Aquinas, of course, the greatest, really, of the medieval theologians. He uses Aristotle as a tool, really, to do Catholic theology, but also philosophy. Right. And so how would he have taken in a term like democracy? Because the image we have is that the medieval members of Christendom would not have even given a second thought to democracy. They were feudal people, and they just thought everything's futile. Futile is the way to go, right?
That's right. Resistance is futile.
well, not that kind of futile. The other kind of futile.
Yeah. Okay. So St. Thomas, of course, is, you know, taking in Aristotle's understanding of things. He's modifying it a bit from a Christian context. And you get into something of a disputed question, but I think probably the majority scholarly position would say that there was that St. Thomas and those who followed him in the medieval context had a form of popular sovereignty. Now, sovereignty is the right to rule. You know, who rules? The sovereign is the one who rules. So sovereignty is this is the status of ruling. And popular sovereignty, the word popular there has to do with the populace or the people. And so that there is a kind of medieval understanding of this, not that everybody fully imbibed it or agreed about it or that sort of thing, but going back to this idea you see in Aristotle and others that that the ruler really needs to rule with some form of support or approval of those who are ruled.
Okay.
Whether that's in the form of the king is ruling or the individual, one man, or a group of people, or the people at large are ruling. So whether we're talking monarchy, aristocracy, or democracy in the good sense, that they need to whoever rules in some way or another with the consent of those who are ruled. Now, we're familiar with this expression from the Declaration of Independence having to do with consent of the governed. It's not exactly the notion that St. Thomas is talking about, but there's a core idea behind that that's common, that government is that God gave man an intellect and a will to be able to direct his affairs to God freely and to organize his communities in such a way that they can thrive so that they can fulfill God's purpose for them. And so that means that there's a certain freedom that human beings are given to manage their affairs consistent with what God wants for them. And so if there is someone who's exercising authority in the community for the good of the community, not his own good, but the good of community, he needs to exercise that with the approval in some way of the people over whom he's exercising authority. So that's a kind of notion of popular sovereignty, 13th century style, we'll say.
But if I may, in the 13th century or 14th century, Would there have been anything like voting, or would there have been anything like popular rule anywhere?
Not in the popular way as we think of it. Although there were, you know, there was voting in religious communities to vote for the heads of these communities. There was a form of voting that took place among the aristocracy, oftentimes for office holding, and so it wasn't as if this were unheard of altogether. But the idea of popular vote, going down to the voting booth, things of that sort didn't exist.
Well, I was thinking of like the Italian republics or the medieval towns.
Later on, yes.
Oh, that's later.
That's right. These things start to emerge where you have a developing or an emerging merchant class that has to manage its own affairs. And so these things emerge in the high Middle Ages, late Middle Ages, in the early Renaissance, early modern period. But something to be said about this, and this comes up when we talk about American society. People say America was not founded as a democracy. They'll say America was founded as a republic. And that's true. We were founded as a republic. People who say this sometimes say that critically, and sometimes they say that because they think that democracy is a bad idea.
Yeah.
Those who say it critically will say, they'll criticize Jefferson, Declaration of Independence, when it says all men are created equal, and they're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. People say, Jefferson says all men are created equal. That's not the way American society was set up in the 18th century. And that's a negative thing. They'll see that critically. They'll say American founding was hypocritical.
Yeah.
That in itself is a long discussion. We're having a book published in January by Robert Riley that kind of engages that issue. It's a book, trying to think of the title of the book now, In Defense of America on Trial, A Defense of the Founding is the title. He looks at this question of whether or not American democracy can be defended from a Christian and a Catholic perspective, and also this question of what it meant to talk about all men are created equal in the founding. But we should understand that doesn't mean, although God intends everybody to be able to participate, and this is one of the emphases of Catholic social teaching, and one of the reasons why there's certainly a sense in which we can say democracy is Catholic. John Paul II talks about the importance of participation by all, taking this language from Pius XII and the language from John the 23rd and the Second Vatican Council. This is participation in civil society should be as broad as possible so that everybody should be allowed to participate in some way. And that broad sense of common participation by everybody in the affairs of political society and civil society, in that broad sense, the church is democratic. But the assumption behind that is the same assumption that was behind the reason why voting in the early days of this country was limited. Suffrage was not universal. And that was that to participate adequately, to be able to contribute to the common good, not just be someone proposing the insistence on the exercise of his rights, but to be able to fulfill his duties, his obligations, to participate in that sense, requires a certain kind of formation, if you will, kind of education, a certain level of virtue, so that people understand that participating in political society means voting for the common good, for the things that are the good of everyone, not just my own interest, but the interest of everybody, and to develop a certain level of virtue where I'm habitually inclined to work for and support what is good for everyone, and not just inclined to work for and support what's good for me. So go back to the discussion about Aristotle. The founders were very much aware that you could have majorities voting for their interests over the interests of all. And so therefore they wanted to make sure that those who were recognized as among the people who could vote, who could participate, when we say in the Declaration of Independence, the preamble, when it says, we the people, who are the people? The people there are the people who are regarded as being able to exercise and contribute to the common good. It's sufficient understanding what it meant to be a citizen, and were sufficiently or minimally virtuous enough to contribute. Now, one of the problems of American democracy early on is that the way that was limited to men, to white people, the franchise, the ability to participate politically was regarded as something that only men could do, or property holders could do, white males, and so on. And gradually, over the 250-year history of the United States, we've expanded our understanding. We understand that everybody should be brought to a level where he or she can participate, can contribute politically in our society. So our earlier conversation, we're talking about people who are, you know, only interested in themselves, only interested in pursuing what they regard as their own good. That understanding of democracy is diametrically opposed to the understanding of self-government that says the people who participate need to be educated in order to participate well, and they need to exercise at least a modicum of virtue in order to do it. Now, I'd say that would be true whether we had a society ruled by the one, by the few, or by the many, but certainly true in a society that is ruled by the many. It's very hard to do, by the way.
Well, as we're seeing, wouldn't you say that the current state of our society illustrates the point of how difficult it is to do, because we do have a tremendous patrimony. I don't know, are you allowed to use the word patrimony anymore? But we have a tremendous inheritance from generations that came before us, both in England and medieval Europe and all that, but also here in our own country for hundreds of years. And it appears now that human beings are capable of squandering that patrimony very, very quickly if they get right down to it.
Yeah, and one of the criticisms.
I got to take a break. So, sure. So let me take the break, and we'll come back and see, is there hope for our democracy, or is it sounds like you might be approaching saying democracy is compatible with the Catholic faith, but you got to do it right. And I want to confront you slightly with the critiques of one Patrick Deneen, who
sure.
is as a great deal of notoriety from his Catholic critique of American liberal society. We'll do that when we come back on the other side with Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press.
Hello, this is Archbishop Alexander Sample of the Archdiocese of Portland in Oregon. Keep that dial right here on Catholic Answers Live.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
Ever wonder about the power of prayer? St. John Chrysostom states that prayer and converse with God is a supreme good. It is a partnership and union with God. As the eyes of the body are enlightened when they see light, so our spirit, when it is intent on God through prayer, is illumined by His infinite light. Let God's infinite light be your guiding light. Ask Him to guide you daily in your prayer, work, recreation, home life with family, and your friendships.
If you're not questioning democracy and its long-term potentials right now, I don't know if you've been paying attention to what's actually going on in the world, but Mark Brumley is president of Ignatius Press, longtime social ministry director himself, and a man well acquainted with the social teachings of the Catholic Church. And so we're here to discuss with Mark whether democracy is compatible with the Catholic faith. As a matter of fact, the question of the hour is democracy Catholic. Just so you know, second hour, we're going to talk because Labor Day comes in conjunction with September 2nd this year. It doesn't always, but September 2nd is actually a very important date in the history of the church. It is the date of the massacre of priests during the French Revolution in 1792. And we'll talk about that. And that gives us a little different perspective on European liberalism and its compatibility with the Catholic faith. But the blood of those martyrs is still on the walls of the church there in where they were killed over a period of days. during the French Revolution. So we'll do that next hour with Father Hugh Barber, our chaplain. America is much more mild-mannered in its liberalism and in its democracy than France. So it does seem that in many, many ways, as Catholics have come to America and assimilated here, they've found it amenable to their – it's perfectly consistent with their Catholic faith. I mean, whole generations of Americans saw no conflict with being fully Americanized and fully Catholic. Were they wrong in that? Were they right? How should we look at that?
I would say that it's hard to answer the question, were they right or wrong, simply because there certainly are facets of American society that, you know, whether this, again, we get into the debate, what goes back to the founding vision, what's the controlling idea of the founders, as opposed to, you know, other things that may have been believed by them and things that may have been part of American society. You get a huge debate. You mentioned Patrick Deneen, and I respect a lot his book on liberalism and the critique of it. Yeah. I think he makes some good points. There'd be some things that I would say I don't necessarily wholly agree with, and I think to some extent Robert Riley's book that I mentioned earlier is coming out in January will, you know, does critique some of Deneen's arguments. Mm-hmm. But I would say, yeah, there were certainly elements of American society that Catholics should have been, you know, and were, many Catholics were very cautious about, very questioning about. That's true today. But I don't think it need be the case. I don't think it's necessary that someone who subscribes to the vision, I'll say the controlling ideas of the founders and constitutional order of American society, that necessarily that society had to develop in some of the ways in which our society developed that are at odds with Catholic teaching on some very fundamental issues. That needn't have happened.
Would you say that Deneen's argument is that it is actually it did need to have that there was a fundamental conflict?
Right. That what we've gotten here, not just in America, but in liberalism more generally, political liberalism more generally, is just a playing out of elements that were there from the beginning, and then over the course of time, as circumstances arise, these principles get developed, and here we are. And I think that would be okay. One of the key ideas of his argument, and I would say that I don't buy that necessarily, but I do agree that there is no political order that you simply establish that political order and then things will automatically be great. Any political order that's established in human history is ultimately under judgment. And that means it's going to fall short of the kingdom. And so to the extent that you can have some political systems that are better than others, all other things being equal, but even in those better political systems, and I would make the argument that democracy is better than many other forms of government, but even there, we're talking about a system of government involving human beings, and there is a minimum level of virtue that's necessary for people to participate well in democracy and to have a just society. It's not simply a matter of passing the right laws or having the proper political institutions. You have, or even having the correct candidates for public office. You have to have an electorate in a democratic society, even a democratic republic, as this is. You have to have an electorate with a certain freedom, an ability to use its freedom well, to educate itself on civic responsibilities, political society, candidates, and issues. And then for people to vote well, or run for office well, in the interest of the common good. And that's not easy. One of the reasons why we face such a challenge in our society. We talk about democracy really in the sense that universal suffrage is just a little bit more than 100 years old. I mean, we're really talking about women's suffrage as something just came about 100 years ago. So half the population couldn't vote. And even in this country, where in theory, men could vote, there were segments of our society as recently as 60 years ago where black men could not vote effectively.
Right.
So when we talk about democracy, when you understand democracy in the sense of universal suffrage is really a fairly recent phenomena in American society. And the idea that you're going to let everybody vote has with it a corollary that says people have to be educated sufficiently well to vote, and they have to acquire a certain minimum amount of virtue to vote well, to be good citizens.
They have to be formed.
They have to be formed.
Yeah.
And you talk about education, and we're trying to educate the whole of the population of the United States of America. That's a humongous task. That's something that's never been done in the history of the world. And we decided tacitly by extending the suffrage to everybody, we tacitly took on the task of educating everybody and doing it in at a time when America was questioning its Christian foundations, its ethical, not that Christianity is reduced to ethics and morality, but Christianity is an important component of our ethics and our morality in this society. And so to have those things both happening at the same time, having to educate everybody and to have radical confusion about core ethical moral values in our society, for those things to happen at the same time poses immense challenges to American democracy. I don't think it's because democracy itself is flawed, but it is challenging. It's high maintenance. It's a high maintenance activity, ethically speaking. And the church has something to say about that.
So that's a striking formulation, because it does help you to understand, if you accept what you just said, some of the weirdness of the world we live in, that at the very moment when suffrage is being extended to everyone, there's also a kind of, really, there's a technological revolution that makes a kind of media possible that pollutes society in many ways.
That's right.
And so at the very moment you're opening every hand to vote, you're also poisoning every mind with this sick media culture we have.
That's right. And you also have an economic, not to sound Marxist or anything, but you have an economic base in this country where people can, where the acquisition of substantial wealth becomes possible for larger and larger segments of the population. Now, get into the complicated question of what's a just distribution of wealth, but the point is that more and more people see that they could live decent lives, and they then therefore desire to live decent lives, but they can also become susceptible to the abuse of economic wealth and become greedy. I'm not just talking about now the elites, but we can succumb to a form of greed in the form of consumerism. And the popes have been very critical of, and John Paul II, when he wrote his letter to his apostolic exhortation in the church in America, meaning North America and South America, one of the things he warned against was consumerism. That happens. That becomes possible only when you have a certain level of economic wherewithal and an awareness among society of, what's available. And so you're right. If I were the devil and I wanted to corrupt the society, I would try to keep people as confused about these kinds of things as possible and utilize all the wherewithal of the media to make people indulgent, self-absorbed, wanting pleasures, interpreting Jefferson's language about the pursuit of happiness to mean, just self-indulgence and things of that sort. And I would be able to corrupt American society.
It sounds like really what you're saying is, given the current circumstances, democracy is compatible with Catholic faith. Catholic faith can add a great deal to help democracy. And I'm adding this myself, but I feel like I'm hearing this. What we need is a lot of Catholic radio to open.
Well, we need a lot of education, formation, virtue, and the Catholic Church has a lot to contribute. I know there will be people who hear that and will laugh with all the problems we've had with corruption in the church in the last 50 years and confusion in the church in the last 50 years. But the Catholic Church does have something to contribute if we can get our act together minimally to contribute it.
Yeah, it does sound like a reinvigoration of Catholic education is an important starting point, because we have not maintained well the full Catholic faith in many of our Catholic schools.
Yeah. And we come back and have another discussion about how what we've talked about common participation applies to life of the church. Some of the same problems we have with democracy, we have with a common participation among all the faithful in the life of the church.
Praise God. All right. Well, that means you have to come back.
Very good.
Mark Brumley, thank you very, very much for this Labor Day conversation.
Great.
Mark is president of Ignatius Press. You should find out what they're up to over at Ignatius.com. He is also the author of The Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics. And at some point in his life, he's committed them all. Is that correct? I think you probably
have.
Thanks, Mark. Next up, Father Hugh Barber. We're going to talk about the massacre of priests in the French Revolution and a little bit about what that says about living in the modern world as a Catholic right after this.